Okay, good morning, Professor Lubinsky. Thank you very much for sitting down with us. As we've discussed ahead of this interview, the main topic of this discussion will be about the period during which replica symmetry breaking was formulated, roughly from 1975 to 1995. But to get to that, I wanted to ask you a few questions on background, if you allow us. So in particular, in a recent oral history interview that was deposited at AIP, you detailed how you decided to pursue studies in physics and then a PhD in theoretical physics, and how you got to do a postdoc in France as well. And in that interview, you mentioned that initially your plan was to work with André Blondin, but that once you arrived in France, he was, I guess, emotionally unavailable, which eventually led you to work with Dejean. But could you tell us a bit what got you interested in working with Blondin or to know his work? What was the original intent?
Well, you know, in many ways, my graduate experience, though I learned a lot, was unfortunate in a sense. You know, my thesis was far and away the worst piece of work I've ever done. But you know, Martin at the time, Paul Martin, who was my advisor, you know, he was applying these Schwinger techniques to condensed matter physics. They had this paper in the late 50s that they wrote. And a lot of his thesis students, you know, Pierre Hohenberg, Kadnoff, all those people were basically doing various versions of it. So at the time, I guess there were experiments going on doing neutron scattering at Brookhaven to study the excitation spectra of magnets. And so my project was to do set up a hydrodynamic theory of magnetic systems. Ferromagnetic mostly, not too much anti-ferromagnet. And, you know, I plugged away on Martin's technique while Halperin and Hohenberg were developing the correct way of doing broken symmetry hydrodynamics. But in any event, I was involved in magnetism. And I had gone to Les Zouches in 67, and Martin had lots of contacts in France. So I thought I really wanted to go to France and have a good time, so to speak. So I applied to Blondin. He said yes, because he was, you know, reasonably well known. Yeah, I'd fiddled around a little bit with the various models of magnetism. And I arrived, and, you know, he was not really functioning. And Dejean, whom I had probably heard this in my thing, I'd met him at Les Zouches. We had a little bit of a guitar connection. And when I arrived at building that was at Saint-Saëns, what was it? No, I've forgotten the numbers. Anyhow, it was while they were still down below the condensed matter people with the nuclear group. And he came in one day and said, "Oh, I know you. You're from we met in Les Zouches." And he immediately invited me down to his house to eat and everything. And so I saw all of the liquid crystal people there, and clearly liquid crystals were far more interesting at the time than magnetism, even though work spawned then led to the Nobel Prize for Albert Fer, really. But I thought at the time it was kind of dull. And so I just followed along there and pretty much on my own. You know, I didn't write a paper with Dejean at all. But I did, you know, write a paper at the time, which was, I think, well received, all alone. And I was then on an adventure, so to speak, because liquid crystals really were a new thing that most physicists didn't know about. And that's the best place to be, is someplace where you have virgin territory.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't end up talking to Blondin at all? You didn't stay in touch
with
him?
Well, no, I talked to him, and I had a very nice dinner at his house and so forth. You know, I wasn't avoiding him, but... the liquid crystal stuff was much more interesting.
Sure. Yeah. You first started working on disordered systems a few years later, after having joined Penn, right, with one of your Penn colleague, Brooks Harris.
Yes, right.
Can you tell us how that collaboration developed and how these ideas developed?
Well, so first of all, when I arrived at Penn, but I should say I spent a postdoc with Leo Kadanoff at Brown, And I got to know a little bit about, you know, his thinking on critical phenomena, even though he was working on solving the problems of the cities at that time. And I got the job at Brown, and, you know, all of the people I knew and sort of respected in Paul Martin's orbit, Halperin and Hohenberg and a couple of others and so forth. And I decided I would, that was looked like a thing I should do. So Bert told me about the, I'm going to forget names now when I shouldn't forget names, the Wilson notes that were eventually published. And so I went through that, and I found a problem to do in renormalization group on semi-infinite systems, which I did with a colleague at Penn. And so I was doing, I learned how to do the renormalization group, actually the old-fashioned form that Wilson did. And I'd been working on liquid crystals, and it struck me that there was something there. So I tried to do the pneumatic to symmetric A transition with the renormalization group, and I kept finding no fixed point. And so, you know, and I had enough sense to do the superconductor as well. And so when I went to Aspen, Bert was there, and he wanted to do the superconducting thing. And so I got involved with that. And then, you know, things are really a little bit funny and serendipitous. At that time you were allowed to just make up models to play with. And we had the Degen Landau theory of liquid crystals, and we thought, well, we should do actually it was a Dick Priest who was, Richard Priest, I should say, was a student of Harris's. And he had left and gone to NRL, but we started a little collaboration. And, you know, we wrote a paper on models with symmetric traceless tensors and calculated the critical exponents there, and, you know, noted that we would let the third order term be to zero. And Richard made an observation that was very interesting. He said, well, you know, maybe there's a six dimensional something here because of the third order thing. So I was aware of that. But then we had a postdoc who came in, Robert Hoylst, I think his name was, H-O-L-Y-S-T. I actually prepared here, I had intended to send you a list of the publications that were relevant. Let's see if I can just find it here, one sec. Here we go. So it was Holcomb.
Okay.
Holcomb. And he was interested in percolation.
Mm-hmm.
And he had access to these papers by, it's terrible how all of the names I know again, the Dutch group. I'll come back to the name later on. Anyhow, they had shown that, you know, the one-state Potts model described percolation. And Gerard Toulouse had written a little note where he did a Degen-type calculation of what the critical dimension for percolation was, and it was six. And so I had this image in my mind that there was something possibly going on in six dimensions, and then we found out about the S equals one limit of the Potts model. And we created a real Wilson type theory, which was later improved by various tricks that other people done. And so we were, you know, aware of six dimensions, and percolation was not far from spin glasses. And then the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick theory came out. And
so before you get there, I wanted to ask you about the 1974 paper with Harris.
Yes.
In which you formulate or you study a model that looks a lot like the Edwards Anderson model, right? Came before.
Let's see. This is 74, I think, is just the...
it's a letter with just Brooks Harris and you.
Yeah, so this is the random systems one, right?
Yes. But the Hamiltonian you're looking at is essentially, I mean, it's a version of the Edwards Anderson with a non-zero ferromagnetic contribution, right? But you could take that to zero,
right? And of course, we were not so sophisticated in creating the most efficient models. One must say that Wilson himself played a role in that. Brooks had just come back from England on a sabbatical, and he was interested in random spin systems, just as a general problem. And Wilson came to visit, gave a lecture, and in my office, we were sitting around talking about whether or not you could apply the renormalization group to random systems. And in fairness, Wilson sat there for a couple of minutes and thought and said, well, what you need to do is to renormalize the probability distribution. And so then we understood that we could, you know, do an expansion in the graphs, and we got diagrams which reproduce the n equals zero trick that actually I first heard about from, he was at Harvard and went to, I know where he went, he went to Copenhagen. And he actually, there's a long story about that too. The guys who first used the replica trick didn't realize that the probability distribution for the J's had to have a positive definite cumulant. And so they found a fixed point, which is in the wrong quadrant. But anyhow, that's what started this out. We had no idea about spin glasses at the time. It wasn't until the Sherrington Kirkpatrick paper came along. And so we saw that, and we knew that there had to be some kind of a transition, but I was equipped already with the idea of six dimensions. And so I remember I was sitting in a particularly boring seminar on, I think it was the band structure of something or other at the time. And I had a gotcha moment, and I figured out how to do it, how to convert it into a field theory in which I could do, renormalization group stuff.
So this is work that you then did with your graduate student, right? Or your graduate student at the time, Jinghui Chen.
Yes, Jinghui Chen. And Brooks continued in the work with that, yeah.
Okay. So the genesis, I don't want to really use my own words, but so you had been, so Brooks Harris had been looking at systems with disorder, including a Hamiltonian very close to the Edwards Anderson or Sherrington Kirkpatrick one, and you had been interested in our genes systems. And
I mean, we viewed it as basically putting random J's, but the J's were not such. I mean, they were random around a finite value, and so we didn't yet confront the spin glass business where it was around an average zero value.
So, had you heard of spin glasses at that point at all, or
not at all? No. Okay. I mean, that was one of the interesting things about the renormalization group at the time was that there were so many problems throughout physics that you could apply the idea to that were, new to the renormalization group. So we did that, and I did the paper alone where I meticulously did the diagrams with the Wilson technique, if you wish, not the n equals zero trick. But I think we got the right answers there at least. It wasn't always that we got the right answers. So that was the beginning of that. And then, of course, we learned the replica trick and wrote some papers on that.
So what was the reaction to your work on the 6 minus epsilon expansion?
Oh, it was well received on the percolation problem.
No, I meant on the spin glass.
It was well received. At that time, Anderson invited me to Princeton to give a talk and everything. It was clearly, I think it was a pretty big thing at the time that it was, you could treat random systems. Right. And of course, we had no idea how much more complicated the spin glass was. I got involved in other things. And I have to say that I would never have come up with the replica symmetry stuff and all of that. And it consumed the efforts of, you know, some of the greatest French scientists for a long time. You know, it really took a long time to get it to work out.
There's something I missed. I wanted to ask you, how actually did you find out about the Sherrington Kirkpatrick or Edwards Anderson papers? Was this through your French connection?
Maybe Brooks got a, you know, that was back in the days when we circulated preprints, you know, we had this big mailing cost. I don't remember the details of that. There was a paper that appeared. We had it. We looked at it. We were not particularly fond of that kind of mean field theory where you had everything interacted with everything else. I mean, it was a nice tool. We were able to. I'm not really sure how much impact all of this stuff had on real experiments, because the spin glass were really complicated. And, you know, we used to go to talks and there would be the experimentalists who were talking about some, you know, crazy alloy. And it was hard to make contact between the two, frankly. Yeah.
So how connected were you to France and Europe throughout those years when you were a junior and then associate professor and in particular, so I'm asking this with a particular context in mind, right? So Blandin, for instance, is one of the first few people to propose a replica symmetry breaking scheme. And I want to know if you had kept abreast of those.
I didn't, you know, I didn't have contact with him anymore. More I had contact with the field theorists, you know, Brezin, Saint-Justin, Jacques Toulouse, it's where I spent a year at the ANS with him there. And, we learned a lot together there. And then there were others. There was, I can remember the guy in Grenoble. He did a lot on spin glasses, and his name escapes me at the moment. Had a very nice chalet, as I recall, there. You know, if it's important, figure out what his name is. At that time, you know, France really was, I think, the champion of the renormalization group, field theoretic, the formalisms. And I learned from them. I even did, you know, some instantons and things like that on some things,
So around, you know, after your work on RG of spin glasses, you stopped paying interest on spin glasses for a few years, at least according to your publication record.
Yeah.
Then you went on a Guggenheim fellowship to Paris, right? That's where you worked with.
So this is 81-82. Yeah.
81-82, and that's where you started working with Gérard Toulouse, I think, more.
Yeah, we really didn't do much together. There were just a couple of papers that we did. You know, mostly I spent my time preparing my French lectures, you know, which it was amazing. I had people from all over Paris who came to it. There must have been 100 people who attended those lectures.
Yeah. But is that when you became acquainted with the replica symmetry breaking ideas? I mean, because you wrote a paper about spinning glasses then?
When did I first hear about? I heard about them pretty quickly, you know, with the inventor of it, the Italian guy,
Parisi.
Parisi, yes, yeah. And you know, I saw him. Yeah, I had done before I went on that sabbatical 81-82. There was a conference in Italy, in Rome, I went to, where I talked about applying those techniques to the localization problem. I don't know how much you've followed there, but you know, we developed what we loved. It was a wonderful theory of the transition to conducting states and so forth. And it was totally wrong. But it was, you know, we were able to show that it was in the same universality class as Lattice animals. We had a theory where we did the instantons and showed where the localized states were. But it gave that the density of states at the transition was zero. And parent, you know, you could show rigorously that was not true. So that's something that's still, but then as Parisi, I know his eyes lit up a little bit and tried to, he had mentioned it several times later, but I heard from people.
Okay. Did working on spin glasses influence at all the rest of your research? Is there some connection we should maybe, or hidden connection we might be able to see?
Well, you know, I did actually, I guess with Jing Wei, I left some mysteries behind, if you wish. You know, we looked at the intersection between spin glasses and the ordered state. There's a critical point between the ferromagnetic and the spin glass thing. And when we did it in the Heisenberg as opposed to the Ising model, we got this fixed point with a complex exponent. And it drove us crazy, you know, because it does a spiral and we didn't know what to do with it. So we had to point it out. But so, you know, I did much more of percolation after that. And, you know, percolation was sufficiently close that we, you know, washed out a little bit. But I really got discouraged by the complexity of the spin glasses. So it was pushing the limits of my analytical abilities. And these other things came along, you know, shortly thereafter, the quasicrystals came up and all that. So I moved on to other things. And then, you know, later on, I got more sucked into experimental things, which actually was a lot of fun too.
So thanks to, I mean, you have a pretty intimate understanding of both the US and American physics communities.
Yeah.
Could you help us understand maybe the difference in response to ideas of replica symmetry and replica symmetry breaking between?
Well, you know, there was the conflict between the Fishers and Parisi. They were not too fond of the spin glass stuff that was going on in Europe. And I think vice versa. You know, we were surprised actually over here how much effort was going into the replica symmetry breaking. And it was really quite a long period before it was resolved. De Dominicis, I had a lot of contact with him and with. You know, it's terrible. You get to be my age. Names just disappear. Anyhow, yeah.
Okay.
It happens to me all the time. So.
Excuse me?
It happens to me all the time and I'm 40. So.
And we're half your age. So.
I fully understand you.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, forgetting names, you mean. Yes. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. I forget all the names of the people I know.
Right.
So during your Lesueux lectures in 1978, right, there was the ill-condensed matter.
Yes, right. That was well received, that one.
Yeah, so in those lectures, you do mention the infamous replica trick.
So I knew about it by then, yeah.
So what was first infamous in your mind at that point? And second, how important was this school from your perspective?
Excuse me, how was that? What?
So what was infamous in your mind at that point about the replica?
I think it was Luther. That's who, Alan Luther was the first, wrote the first papers on the replica symmetry breaking that I saw. I don't know if he invented it, but it was the first. And he made this mistake about the sign. So he had a fixed point which corresponded to having a positive definite quantity negative. And that's why I called it infamous.
Okay.
But in fact, you know, I employed it all afterwards. And, you know, I think it really is a valid trick. I mean, until you hit the spin glass stuff, it basically was a good way of you know, keeping track of the diagrams. It really was that, you know, as long as you were perturbative, it was a safe thing. But then, you know, there was a lot of doubt whether the replica symmetry made any sense, et cetera. And I think justifiably at the time.
One thing that I forgot to ask about, because you started to work with Toulouse and then you wrote a few papers, but you also wrote with his collaborator, Ramal.
We did one, at least one of the papers I think that Girard wrote and put my name on it. I'm not sure I even knew it. The thing with Ramal were these superconducting loops that we worked on. That also led to another RG thing. You know, I did one on superconducting lattices with another name I've forgotten, who has since become famous with light scattering and things like that, light localization.
So you never interacted much with Ramal himself?
We interacted a fair amount. He visited us at Penn for a while. We talked about things. He was a bright guy, a little strange. And then, of course, he had his unfortunate early demise. I knew him, but not too much. Mostly, Girard was my French teacher. Right down to it, you know, he was a perfectionist, as you know, and he would. That was very useful to be corrected constantly.
I see. Getting back to the replica trick, you taught the replica trick at the Dejou School, but is there any other context in which you taught the replica trick after that?
Well, I certainly taught it in the renormalization group classes I taught at Penn. Where else did I teach it? I don't think, you know, particularly. I mean, it was something everybody used at the time. I didn't, have any special relation to it other than it was a useful tool.
I'm mentioning this because in your book in particular, right, in Principles of Condensed Matter Physics, you do not mention spin glasses or the replica trick or replica or random systems.
Right. No, I debated about that, but I sort of ran out of steam because I guess the reason why I didn't put it in my book was it really is an enormous topic in itself. And to pick and choose, I just felt it was too much. It was certainly something that we discussed, Paul and I, but after 10 years of writing the book, we just didn't have the energy to do any more. And, you know, in some ways, some of the random things were a little more disappointing than they could have been because we had all of this beautiful machinery that didn't always agree with experiments. And so I was just a little discouraged about it. And I felt that if I were teaching the generation that you know, my people would have, when my book was available, I thought it was less fundamental than the stuff I was actually put in the book.
But you mentioned, so that's not necessarily a reflection of what you were really teaching in the classes at Penn, where you were teaching about disordered systems?
The renormalization group I taught, well, it's true that that was before the book that I taught classes that had the randomness in it. Yeah. You know, there's really a lot to get through. And yeah. Anyhow, I talked about it actually with Alan McCain, who was a postdoc of mine. We did a couple of things. He and I had wrote half a book during my visit to Paris. And again, it's one of these things that where we had it all written out and then didn't go anywhere.
About disordered systems or?
About disordered systems, yeah.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, disorder, yeah. I don't know if I can find my notes on it, but.
Yes, if you find your notes, that'd be very interesting, the answer. Is there anything else about that era that you think would be of interest that we might have skipped over, though?
Well, you know, I think the percolation problem actually had, you know, big impact on how we thought about random systems, I think. And I probably there are more people who worked on percolation than on spin glasses. Well, you know, I could say the other thing about that era that I, you know, the work we did on the what we call lattice animals, that was a big surprise. And then all of this stuff about, you know, dimensional reduction, what is, you know, you have theories in six dimensions, which really apply to four dimensions and all of that, but the Yang-Li edge and all of that business. So there were all of these really surprising and very nice applications of renormalization group to problems that were of interest to all kinds of people. You know, the polymer people liked, you know, the statistics of polymer clusters and things like that. So I would put that in the general group of things that were in the air in the spin glass period.
And it would be fair to say that you found those more rewarding because there was a better reception.
Well, it was something that I knew how to control. I didn't know how to deal with the... I mean, the replica symmetry breaking is a very technically complex thing. And so, you know, I saw all of the stuff coming out of France and Italy, and I knew that for me to be able to contribute, I would have to sit down and spend a lot of time. And there were all these other things going on which were more accessible to me at the time.
Yeah. Absolutely. So do you still have notes, papers, and correspondence from that epoch? And if you do, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
Oh, wow. notes, you know, I have stacks and stacks of notes. I had notes on most of the papers I wrote, but when I look at them now, they're... you know, sometimes hard to get a hold of, but, you know, I have a whole office that I've got to clean out now with papers all over the place. I was pretty, you know, careful about saving notes which were relevant to the papers I have. But you know how it is when you write notes, you write them and then you find there's a mistake and you rewrite them a little bit. And so when you go back and look at them, remember, this is not just shy of 50 years ago. So, you know, memory is a little thing. But what kind of things would you find interesting?
I mean, your correspondence with your co-authors, correspondence with the community in general, the notes on your work, or, I mean...
You know, I may have some. You know, the person I exchanged more letters with was Amnon Aharoni. Who at the time was really one of the leading guys in the RG business. But, you know, writing letters, well, even before the internet came on board, there was less letter writing than there were. In the early 70s, I certainly wrote a number of that. Whether I have those letters or not, I don't know. I can, if I ever get back into my office, I could have a look if you really think that's the sort of thing you would find interesting.
I mean, I would definitely encourage you to contact the Rare Books and Manuscript Archives at UPenn to deposit at least some of the more salient or relevant pieces for that. Yeah, I mean, no, the notes from the books you didn't publish, for instance.
Yeah, can I find those notes? Yes. Yeah, I've half written another book on. For sophomores on waves, which is probably not so interesting. You know, some people were aware of impact on history and thought about it from the very beginning of their career. Frankly, I never thought I was going to have an impact, so I didn't, it took me a while to develop the self-confidence that one needs to you know, think in advance about those things. I always felt under the shadow of all of the Fisher, Martin, Halpern crew, you know, who were always the ones who never made mistakes and were always in the front row harassing the speakers. And you know.
Famously so, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. I'd be interested to see where this all goes.